This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. In the last decade, North Carolina's undocumented population grew by 53%, we guess. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, works to detain and deport those who come here without documentation. But what happens to families when those deportees are parents? Today, we're going to look at immigrants and the child welfare system. It's the second part of our series of conversations on immigration. Joining us in the studio is Anique Lenore Peake. She is an appellate defender and a parent representation coordinator with the North Carolina Office of Parent Representation. Anique, welcome to you. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much.
Also with us is Donna Shoemate, an attorney in Sparta, North Carolina. She handled a custody case involving a deported father and joins us now by phone. Donna, welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
Tell us about Felipe Montes.
Mr. Montes came to the United States in 2004. He was undocumented. He married a U.S. citizen and became the father of three children. He was picked up by immigration and was deported. And afterwards, the mother was having difficulty raising the children on her own. And the child welfare system, the Department of Social Services, took custody of the three children. And then Mr. Montes fought for 2 years to regain custody of his children and ultimately was able to do so.
What kind of a fight was it? And I guess the Mexican consulate was involved as well. Is that right?
That is correct. It was a very difficult fight. And initially, the department's recommendation was to terminate Mr. Montes' parental rights because he had been deported. And the department's position initially was that the children would be better off being adopted by U.S. citizens than being sent to Mexico to live with their father. The Mexican consulate did become involved, and they were able to help do a home study of Mr. Montes' home in Mexico to show that it had modern conveniences like a microwave oven, a satellite dish on the roof, things of that nature, to show that he did have a very nice place for these children to live.
So that's a lot, and that's the kind of thing you would do in any kind of a custody battle. Let's look at the home situation, where they're going to be placed. This is complicated by the fact that the home is not in the United States. The consulate gets involved, gets that done in Mexico. Anique, tell me about this. This seems to be unique in some ways in that he was married to an American citizen. There was somebody here. His wife was still in this country, although having some problems and not deemed fit by Child Protective Services. How often does it happen that both parents are deported and the children are left with no parents or both of their parents back in Mexico?
Well, it is unusual in the sense that there is one parent that is left here, although I have not heard of that many cases where both parents are deported. Very frequently, what happens is that there is one parent that is deported and the other parent is simply missing out of the picture. Either they haven't been heard of for a while or there's just no communication from them. There's no relatives that have appeared in a while. Or one parent is actually facing criminal charges and so therefore will be locked up for a while. So this is a little bit of an unusual situation, but we've actually had several cases go through our office where there is a parent that is a U.S. citizen that is unavailable to care for the children while the other parent has been deported. And thankfully, the Mexican consulate has been very helpful in getting home studies on that parent that has been deported.
How often does this happen, and is this an increasing situation with kids here and a deported parent in Mexico or some other country?
I cannot give you an accurate number of how often it happens because we don't find out about it in our office unless an attorney contacts us for assistance or unless it actually goes up to the Court of Appeals. I have seen an increasing number of cases where the case is now going to a termination of parental rights for one reason or another on the parent that has been deported. And perhaps that is because there has been a delay in getting a home study that has been ordered. Although I will say that because the Mexican consulate is very good about assisting those parents, I'm seeing it more on some of the other countries like Honduras or Nicaragua, where it's a little bit more difficult in getting those home studies completed.
Let's take a look at this picture from the point of view of the children. Tell us about DSS and what happens. A parent is arrested. They're now in detention. What happens to the children, and what is the timetable for DSS?
So once a parent is arrested, if there is no one available to care for them, what the social worker does is they meet with that parent that is arrested and tries to do a safety plan, tries to find out if there is another relative that is available to care for them, whether that is an adult sibling of the children or of that parent that has been arrested, another parent that is a U.S. citizen that is available, and tries to work out kind of a safety placement without court involvement. If that is not possible, then they have to file a petition and obtain non-secure custody, get the court's permission to put the children in foster care. The timetable is that they have to get permanence for the children within a one-year mark. So during that one-year timetable, they're both trying to get a court order that finds that the parent has actually made efforts to regain custody of the children, or that somehow or other there has been some permanence achieved for the children. And that's where the problem comes in. If we can't get a home study done on the parent that has been deported, or if they're still on ICE hold during that time period and we can't get that parent in a position where they can get custody of the child back, now the year is kind of tolling against that parent, and now DSS is really pushing towards getting to permanence for that child.
So, Donna Shumay, talk about the complications or difficulties in making communication when a parent is in the custody of ICE and not in jail. Is there a difference between trying to communicate with someone in jail and someone at a detention camp?
Well, pure geography comes into play, because if a person is detained locally in a local jail, I could still gain access fairly readily. I'm not sure that I couldn't gain access at an ICE facility, but generally that facility, if a person were arrested in northwestern North Carolina, they would go to Georgia near Atlanta. And so physically, it's just difficult to arrange the transportation for the attorney to even go meet with a person. They do have some access to telephone, but it's very limited, and most of the time that is used to confer with family members rather than with the attorney.
And until recently, ICE would not necessarily disclose which facility that parent was being held at. So it was even more difficult for the attorney to try to get in touch with that parent and to communicate with them. Fortunately, as of August 23rd, ICE has changed its policy and has made it much more easy for the attorneys to remain in contact with their client, and has actually made it a policy that any time that a parent has been detained, that there will be a facilitator at every location that will ensure that there is not only ready access for that parent and their attorney, but ready access between that parent and any court that may be involved with their children.
Donna, in the case of Felipe Montes, were you having to do that? Were you having to go back and forth between Felipe and then DSS? I guess you're having to negotiate all of those, that whole framework, right?
Well, actually, when I was first appointed to Mr. Montes, he had already been deported to Mexico. He was arrested in October of 2010. And by February of 2011, when I was appointed, he was already in Mexico, so I was having to converse with him via cell phone, which was not the most reliable form of communication. Also, although he spoke some English, I felt like when it came to legal terms that I was having difficulty explaining certain things, and so occasionally I'd have to get someone to interpret for me. So the communication was difficult.
And what about, did he have to come back here? I understand that he really had to obtain a special visa to come back for hearings in this country to finish this process. Is that right?
That's correct. He didn't have to, but it was certainly to his benefit to be here. We initially tried to do a hearing and use Skype to allow him to participate in the hearing with limited success. At some point, the consulate was able to obtain an immigration attorney who did get humanitarian parole for him to come back to this country for the sole purpose of testifying in court. And he arrived back in this country August of 2012, and because of various delays in court proceedings and then ultimately a judge ordering a trial placement with him and the children, he stayed until March of 2013.
Anique, how, in this case, Felipe Montes was successful in regaining custody of his children. Normally, what happens? What happens ordinarily?
Well, that's pretty unusual that they regain custody. First of all, Felipe Montes is the only person that I'm aware of, at least in North Carolina, that was able to get this humanitarian visa to come back and to spend time. And Ann Robertson, who was the attorney who represented him from the immigration standpoint, actually got it extended several times so that he could stay, and also allowed him some time to have care of his children while he was here in North Carolina to show to the court that he could care for his children. So that's extremely unusual. I've never seen that happen before. I was involved in a case out of Mecklenburg County where actually I represented the deported father, and I was successful in getting the court of appeals to affirm the child being placed with a deported father. So it has happened in other counties as well. But usually that does not happen.
You know, Tim, I'm up against a break here, Donna, but that's interesting. It suggests that you need an immigration attorney who knows that law on the one hand, and then you're talking about the kind of custody battles, which is a whole different set of laws. So now he's got to have two attorneys just to get this thing really finalized. Is that right, Donna?
That is correct, and he wasn't entitled to a court-appointed immigration attorney. That was a separate matter.
On the State of Things today, we're talking about families and immigration. Anique Lenore Peake is a parent representation coordinator and attorney with the North Carolina Office of Parent Representation. Donna Shumate is an attorney in Sparta, North Carolina, who handled a deportation custody case. And we will continue our conversation on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. The broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Today, talking about the intersection of child welfare and deportation. It's the second in our series on immigration. Anique Lenore Peake is a parent representation coordinator and attorney with the North Carolina Office of Parent Representation. Donna Shumate is an attorney in Sparta, North Carolina, who handled a deportation custody case. And we're joined now by Nina Rabin, who is a clinical law professor at the University of Arizona. She authored a report called Disappearing Parents, and she joins us from the studios of KUAZ in Tucson. Nina Rabin, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Give us an idea of the scope of this issue at the national level.
Well, we have actually very helpful data that came out from a thorough study by the Applied Research Center. They went to child welfare agencies around the country and got data that's very hard to get because of privacy concerns of the children, but they were able to get through data and interviews an estimate that there's over 5,000 children that are in foster care with a parent that has been either detained or deported. So pretty significant number of children and by all accounts growing. And that's the national number that they came up with.
And in most cases, are parents trying to get custody of their children?
Yeah, so these were all cases where there are proceedings underway, and proceedings always start with the presumption of reunification. And then, as was discussed in the first part of the show, after a certain period of time, it'll switch to termination of parental rights.
And looking at your report, it's pretty clear that there's not much in the way of communication between ICE and Department of Social Services, that those two systems were never really that nobody thought about those two systems together when each one was developing its own means, one to put children in foster care, the other to deport undocumented aliens.
Right, absolutely. I came to this issue because of representation of one individual client who had an experience very, very different from that described about Felipe Montes. My client was deported and ended up having her parental rights terminated to all four of her children, three who were U.S. citizens, and they were all eventually adopted. So I kind of watched it unfold over 3 years, a real tragedy of failure of communication. And so I went on to do interviews in Pima County in Arizona of judges and social workers and attorneys in the family court system to understand whether my client's case was really an anomaly, and it became quite clear that it wasn't, that there was a real disconnect between the way these cases were handled in the child welfare system and the immigration system.
Was it when you found – I mean, did anybody perceive this to be a problem? Was anybody talking about it and trying to get the attention of one or the other service to say, hey, we need to work this out? This is – we have no system here, no framework for communicating about this.
Yeah, I actually heard quite often a sense of frustration in from people in the child welfare system. That's actually the title of the report, Disappearing Parents, were the actual words that people used to describe their experience when parents were picked up by ICE and literally just kind of disappeared. They couldn't track them down, couldn't locate them. And as I think Anique mentioned in the first part of the show, that has hopefully improved so that now there will be an ICE point person for people to go to try to locate parents. But I think there it's an ongoing challenge because detention facilities are so remote and there's so little information about them. So people struggle with that on the child welfare end of things.
Donna Shumate, I wonder how you felt that frustration, if you did, not yourself, but in the people you dealt with. Were they more or less sympathetic and just felt that they didn't have the means to do it, or were people indifferent to the situation? In your case, how did you perceive the people in both of those systems in terms of their sympathies as you went forward with your case?
I think that for the Department of Social Services with which I dealt, this was a new situation for them, and they were even having trouble serving papers on my client to get the action started. And I know they had a sense of frustration just in knowing that this is different and we have to do things differently and not knowing what to do. The Mexican consulate was very gracious and came here and met with representatives from the Department of Social Services and tried to do some education on what services they could help assist with. And I think that was very helpful. But I think, at least in northwestern North Carolina, there is just in general lack of information to attorneys and those of us, other people who deal with the welfare system about what services are available through the consulate, even how to get in touch with the appropriate immigration officers. It's very frustrating and not knowing where to turn.
Anique, it seems to me, you know, we talked about, Nina says, we think about 5,000 cases across the United States. These are kids who are now going to be in foster care, a system that's stretched to the limit. It seems like there would be a financial incentive to find a better answer than we have right now.
Yes, I think that's true. And I see that right now with our court system through its court improvement program is doing some training to help. For example, there is next Friday a training that is being offered to attorneys, DSS attorneys, GAL attorneys, and judges on how to work and use these resources that Donna is saying that we need on improving how to avoid perhaps putting these children in foster care. And actually, I am aware that there are lots of agencies that assist especially undocumented parents in perhaps getting certain documents in place, such as powers of attorneys and having plans in place as to who will provide care to the children should they be picked up by ICE, so that there is a plan of where the children will go, who can sign up for school or get them medical assistance so that we can avoid having the children go into foster care should they be picked up.
And I guess it's not all cost because there are federal matching funds in foster care, right?
That is correct. So if the children are what is called Title IV-E eligible, then there are some federal matching funds that are pay for part of the foster care. It ranges between 50 and 85% of whatever the foster care costs are, which depend on both the state and the county and the age of the children.
Nina Rabin, you know, one of the reasons they're in foster care is because there are no other members of the community and family members who can take care of them. And that, I understand, is due in part to the fact that the families of immigrant families don't necessarily want to identify other family members because they might be in the same situation with regard to documentation. Is that right?
Yeah, this is a huge challenge with this issue because I think, you know, most all child welfare agencies agree now that, you know, the research shows kinship placements are far preferable to foster care, and the effort is really to encourage that. And there's a couple challenges. One is that I think it was discussed in the first part of the show, there's this key window right when a parent is picked up and apprehended that there's an opportunity to identify placements and avoid getting the whole ball rolling with the custody proceedings, if you can locate a family placement, well, if somebody's picked up by immigration, they often aren't in a position to even make those preferences known. But on top of that, there's the concern you've identified that they might just be too fearful to name family members. And, you know, especially it varies somewhat by state. I think in a state like Arizona, where there's so much fear about anyone perceived to be a state authority, immigrants are very unlikely to come forward and volunteer to be a kinship care provider because of that fear.
And Anik, I guess another aspect of this might be DSS folks who are worried about placing kids in that environment for fear that the same thing might happen to the new family.
That is true. And actually, in other states, we've seen court decisions where courts, judges have actually said, I'm not going to place this child in another home where they're likely to be ripped up yet again because another set of relatives is going to be deported and picked up. But what the appellate courts have said is that's highly unlikely to happen. If you look statistically at the number of undocumented immigrants that we have in this country and the small percentage that are actually picked up, that's not likely to happen. When you look at some of the relatives that have been in this country for a number of years, and that it is always preferable to put the children in a relative placement. And so that should be the primary method used as opposed to foster care.
So on that side, DSS and the courts are beginning to relax and think that that might be a good placement, but it still would depend on the perception state to state about how immigrants are treated, and with harsher treatment, it means the impact on children is worse and worse and worse.
Yes, and again, the fear of those relatives as to whether or not there's going to be increased scrutiny on them, especially if they're working under the table because they're undocumented themselves, and are they driving without a valid driver's license, those types of issues that might make them a little bit more of a target for law enforcement.
And Nina, let's talk about the difference between jail and detention centers, because I understand, you know, in jails there are some visitation privileges when you have children. It's not the same in an ICE facility. Is that right?
There actually is visitation in ICE detention facilities, but the biggest issue is geography, as was discussed with Felipe Montes. It's just very often the case that the distance is a real obstacle, particularly if the children are in foster care. So you would be asking the state to use resources to drive children long distances to the facility. The visitation hours vary by facility, but they usually do have, you know, times for family visits. The other challenge, though, facing parents that's different than in jail is often parents who are facing the potential of termination of parental rights have a variety of classes or substance abuse programs or requirements that they need to carry out in order to demonstrate that they are a fit parent. And parents really struggle to respond to those requests by the family court if they're detained. Often jails have the type of programming available to parents, but none of that is going to be available in a detention facility.
Now, one of the advantages we have in North Carolina is that our statute actually says that the parent has to have willfully failed to comply. So the advantage is that if they're actually held in a facility that doesn't have those services, then the argument is made that they didn't willfully fail to comply because they're not available. So
it's an advantage
that's a
benefit here, but it varies state to state. And Donna Shumate, I guess that raises a question for you as an attorney. The fact that you're dealing with state law and federal law, how does that complicate things for you as an attorney?
It wasn't such a complication because we were dealing mainly with state law except for getting Mr. Montes here, and that was federal. But that was basically the only federal issue.
Nina, does that vary from state to state, or is that pretty much the case across the country?
Well, I think that the two systems are definitely both playing a role in the problem, and that there are needs for changes in both. And, You know, one example is California actually did recently pass the first law of its kind in the country to change some of the policies of the Department of Social Services equivalent in California to address these problems. And one of the things they did was to give more flexibility with that timeline we were talking about. So the 1 year to establish permanency, they have an exception when there's immigrant parents and there's efforts to try to locate the parent. So states can actually change the legal framework to accommodate these cases in ways that could have a real impact.
What were Anik, you have been doing this for quite a while. What are some of the changes that you've seen in North Carolina since you started?
A lot of it has to do with actually a cultural understanding of this population. One of the cases I remember handling about 6 years ago, some of the findings of fact by the court and the social worker was there was some domestic violence in the home, and the social worker had said, like, there were only 2 days worth of food in the cabinet. And so the mother had been picked up for actually driving with an invalid license. And so she was detained. So there was no one to care for the children. And so they had to put the children in foster care. But the case kind of got out of hand very quickly. And the court actually ordered the parents to be reported for ICE deportation and said, basically, these parents have domestic violence and that's why DSS is involved, which wasn't really true. The reason the kids came into foster care is because the mother had been arrested for driving without a license. And just because she only had 2 days worth of food, whereas you and I might have a month worth of food in our refrigerators that we end up tossing because it goes bad, is just a cultural difference between what they do and what we do. So I don't see that as much. When I see orders that come across my desk that are being appealed, I just don't see those kinds of findings anymore. I think that the Department of Health and Human Services has done a good job of educating the social workers and also the judges about cultural differences, and what we perhaps take as the norm is not necessarily the norm, and that it doesn't affect the health and safety of these children. And so that is not a reason to put these children in foster care.
Nina Rabin, your report emphasizes the importance of bringing the consulates into the picture. Certainly that was the case in Felipe Montes' particular case. Is it a difficult thing to do? How willing is the Mexican government to get involved, to involve its consulates? And is it complicated to bring them into this process? Is there an easy road, an easy path to invite them in and participate?
My sense is that it does vary some by consular office, but that with Mexican consular offices, they've really been quite serious and dedicated to this issue. And so there's a number of examples around the country of consular offices that have developed really, I think, positive relationships with state or local child welfare offices. And I think they recognize that this is, you know, just a really serious problem facing their nationals that are living in this country. So on the whole, I think they're quite open to it. There are some offices that actually have MOU, memorandums of understanding, with the state child welfare offices that, you know, they will be contacted when these cases arise, and they can really develop a working relationship. So I think on the whole, it's a very feasible relationship, but of course there are variations.
Anik, have you been in touch with Felipe, and do we know how he's doing now that he's back with his family?
I have not, but I'm sure Donna has.
Donna?
Yes, I have been in contact with him directly and through his wife, who is still here. And he's having a little difficulty with employment, but otherwise things are fine and the three children are doing well.
In this particular case, how many cases are in the pipeline, Anik? Do we have a sense here in North Carolina how many cases we're dealing with right here?
No. Unfortunately, we do not have a way to track it because the cases, although it's a state DHHS agency, each county has its own agency, so there's no way to track the numbers and know exactly who is involved with an undocumented parent. and children.
And Nina, when you were putting your report together, you talked about the difficulty in obtaining the information, in part because of privacy regulations, but also it seems to me that if you're trying to come up with a sensible solution, having that kind of data is important, and it sounds like it's kind of hard to get.
Absolutely. No, I think that's a huge challenge, both on the child welfare side and immigration. There's just not a lot of data. I think immigration now is starting to release numbers of parents, U.S. parents of U.S. citizen children who are deported. It does keep track of that. But then you have to kind of extrapolate from that to figure out how many of those kids are going to be in foster care.
On today's program, we're talking about immigration and child welfare. It's the second in our conversation on immigration. Anik, Lenore Peek is a parent representation coordinator and attorney with the North Carolina Office of Parent Representation. Donna Shumate is an attorney in Sparta, North Carolina, who handles deportation and custody cases. And Nina Rabin is a clinical law professor at the University of Arizona who studies immigration enforcement and families. We're going to talk about new immigration directive from the Obama administration when our program continues. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking about what happens to families when an undocumented parent is detained or deported. It's the second in our series of conversations about immigration. Anik Lenore Peek is a parent representation coordinator and attorney with the North Carolina Office of Parent Representation. Donna Shumate is an attorney in Sparta, North Carolina. She handles deportation and custody cases. Nina Rabin is a clinical law professor at the University of Arizona and director of the Bacon Immigration Law and Policy Program. Nina, you talked about that California law. How long has it been on the books, and what else does it do, and how effective has it been? Do you know yet?
So it was signed into law in September 2012, so exactly a year now. And I think that it is a little hard to measure exactly how effective it is, but I think that it definitely is perceived to be a step in the right direction, and there are several states that are considering similar laws. So it's definitely a positive development. And I will say that, you know, leading up to this, California was really at the forefront. Several of its counties were already doing many of these things before the state law was passed.
Remind us of the key provisions in that law.
Sure. So one of them I mentioned was giving a little bit more flexibility for the time frame parents have, at the time frame for permanency to establish a permanent home for the child, just to account for the fact that immigration cases do take a very long time to resolve. So not only are there the delays of locating a parent, but also there often are just long waits before you know whether a parent is going to successfully challenge their deportation. So that's a really important piece. It also makes it explicit that immigration status should not be a disqualifying factor in evaluating placement with a relative. So this is the issue we talked about to encourage kinship placements. And it also does favor or encourage these relationships with consulates. So those are some of the key provisions in the law.
Sounds like a fairly progressive idea. We know that Arizona has very strict regulations, very strict attitudes about immigration enforcement. And I wonder if in any way, if this is something that's under consideration in Arizona, if there's any conflict between this kind of approach to families and the very strict attitude that we see in Arizona.
Yeah, you know, I will say that the Department of Child Welfare in Arizona has acknowledged that this is a real concern and has established a working group to look at it. In Pima County, the court is very much taking steps to offer more trainings to address the issue. So while there isn't a bill of this kind in Arizona, I think that there is an increasing recognition by the state child welfare system that it's a concern. On the other hand, it's really hard to address it when there's this overwhelming climate of fear created by other state policies that really cut against efforts to address the problem.
Anik, the Obama administration issued a new directive about the way ICE should handle these cases a few weeks ago. Tell us about that and what impact it might have.
Well, So on August 23rd, they issued a new facilitating parental interest in the course of civil immigration enforcement activity memo, and it took effect that same date. And the purpose of it was to basically facilitate, have a facilitator at any time a parent is detained, in that it involves court in children. So if there is court involvement, there will be a procedure and a point of contact so that the parents can have access to the court facilities. They'll be able to have visitation, as was mentioned. And if not in person because of the distances, at least video, Skype or whatever may be available, or at least telephone visitation. Also, that if they've been deported and there is a necessity for them to travel back, for example, as in the Montes case, for a hearing or at least the termination of parental rights proceeding, that they can petition to do so. So that is definitely a lot of progress in these types of cases. And I'm glad to see that in a written policy that is hopefully going to be a very big step up in helping these parents to regain custody of their children.
Nina, do you expect that new directive to have much impact?
Well, I'm cautiously hopeful. I have to say that ICE has issued a whole series of memos about prosecutorial discretion over the last couple years, telling agents on the ground that they are to prioritize certain dangerous immigrants for detention and deportation, and not necessarily people who are picked up for traffic violations or non-minor offenses. And all along, those memos have said that primary caregivers are one of the groups that should warrant particular consideration. And until now, that's been a pretty disappointing implementation. There hasn't been marked changes in terms of enforcement on the ground. This is great because it is very specific about children who are in the foster care system and primary caregivers. So hopefully now the implementation will really be there to actually change practices on the ground.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being on the program. Nina Rabin, a clinical law professor and director of the Bacon Immigration Law and Policy Program at the University of Arizona. Donna Shumate, an attorney in Sparta, North Carolina, and Anique Lenore Peake, a parent representation coordinator and attorney with the North Carolina Office of Parent Representation. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.